From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in San Ramon.
Larkspur in Marin County.
Simpson Beach.
I live in Noe Valley in Novato.
I live in San Anselmo right next to Fairfax.
Coming up, a federal court ruling could help medical marijuana providers breathe a little easier.
If 50 states say marijuana is legal and they still say it's not legal, who is they?
Then a philosopher considers some deep questions through a creative lens.
I think actually one of the few ways that we can reorganize ourselves and emancipate ourselves from habit and social structure is art.
And we find out the answer to this week's Audiograph Mystery Sound. Come celebrate with us today on Cross Currents. Advocates of legalizing marijuana in California received some encouraging news this week. On Monday, a broad coalition of supporters announced they're backing a 2016 ballot measure. One of those supporting the measure is Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom. This is no surprise. Newsom told talk show host Bill Maher back in August that he's long favored properly regulated marijuana, and he knows the results of legalization here could have an impact well beyond the California state line.
You know, one should not underestimate the impact this will have, not only across the country, but around the world, notably with the cartels down in Mexico. We produce just in the Emerald Triangle, which is that Mendocino, Humboldt area, California, roughly $12 billion of cannabis at wholesale a year.
Though Ohio voters soundly rejected a ballot measure to legalize recreational marijuana on Tuesday, the national sentiment may be changing. Just a few weeks ago, a federal judge in San Francisco ruled in favor of a small Marin County medical marijuana dispensary and against the United States Department of Justice. KALW's cannabis correspondent Stephen Short has been monitoring these issues, and he joins me now. Hey, Stephen.
Hi, Hannah.
Well, campaign posters from Tuesday's election haven't even been taken down yet, and there's already lots of talk about next year's election. What's the situation with legalizing cannabis in California?
Well, legalization here has always been kind of like being a fan of the Chicago Cubs. It's always wait till next year. Big names and big money tend to shy away from this issue, or at least they have. But there has been a game changer, and that's Sean Parker.
Same Sean Parker who founded Napster, the same Sean Parker who was the founding president of Facebook.
That's exactly right. It was widely reported Sunday that he and others have agreed to put millions into the campaign of the Adult Use of Marijuana Act. And one of the other supporters, as we just heard, is Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom.
Why Gavin Newsom?
Well, he sees it to some degree as a health and safety issue, I think. Here's what he said in Humboldt County when he was there back in May.
I think the status quo is untenable, and that perhaps was the biggest lesson of all. The reality that you can't just turn a blind eye and not see what's around you. It's not working for folks. It's not working for the environment. It's not working for our water quality. It's not working for our streams and rivers.
But regulation proposals aren't working right now either because there are too many of them. That's the big task ahead, getting the various stakeholders together so that they all support a unified measure.
So recreational marijuana has already been legalized in many states, Colorado, Washington, Oregon, Alaska, the District of Columbia. How is that working out?
Well, one way to look at it is the money side of it, and it's become very lucrative. Washington State collected nearly $70 million in taxes in its first year of sales. Colorado got nearly that much last year. In fact, Colorado brought in $20 million more from the sales taxes on cannabis than they did from alcohol.
I'm talking with KALW's cannabis correspondent Stephen Short about a flurry of activities surrounding the issue of marijuana in California and beyond. Stephen, let's talk about the federal court decision from a couple weeks back. That could change how federal authorities deal with the medical marijuana dispensaries that we already have.
Okay, well, let's start that story from the beginning.
Okay.
The dispensary at the center in this case was the Marin Alliance for Medical Marijuana in Fairfax. It's considered to be the first licensed dispensary in the state.
Oh, when did it open?
Oh, it opened way back in 1996. Ugh. And it was shut down by the Justice Department in 2011.
Because the federal government classifies marijuana as a Schedule I drug.
That's right. That means it does not have any medicinal value and it's highly addictive.
And so that means medical marijuana is legal in California, but illegal according to the United States.
You find that confusing? Well,
very.
Well, but it's the truth. So the Department of Justice would sometimes bust California dispensaries that were legal under state law.
Okay.
This has been really controversial for the federal government, as you might expect.
Well, because of states' rights.
Because of states' rights, exactly. I talked with the lead attorney in this case. He's a Santa Rosa lawyer named Greg Anton. And he told me Congress passed a law in 2014 requiring the Department of Justice to stop shutting down dispensaries.
Congress told the DOJ and said, you don't have any funding to do activities that interfere with state law in the following states. They named 32 states, including California. The DOJ ignored the law and has been prosecuting people in California and across the country, as they have been for 50 years or more.
Until last month. That's when a federal district judge in San Francisco said no means no. Anton told me that he's not convinced the DOJ will comply.
And as I've said to the court, if 50 states say marijuana is legal and they still say it's not legal, who is they?
Well, it's the Congress, right? Or the government.
I thought they represented the people. I mean, that's what I thought. I thought that's what I was taught in high school.
So, Stephen, did you talk to the Department of Justice about the ruling?
Yes, I called the U.S. Attorney's Office here in San Francisco, and all they could say was that there are similar cases presently working their way through the courts, and since they're not settled, they have no comment.
Okay. Thanks, Stephen.
You're welcome, Anna.
That's KELW's cannabis correspondent, Stephen Short. You can find all sorts of news stories relating to marijuana in Stephen's online cannabis news roundup. Find it at kalw.org. It's updated every Friday. This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. Alva Noe is a professor of philosophy at UC Berkeley with a background in cognitive and brain science. So it makes sense that he writes about the nature of consciousness and human experience. Noe's new book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, explores how art can make us think about life in new ways. Noe talked to KALW's Jen Chien about what art means to us humans and why we make it.
So your new book, Strange Tools, Art and Human Nature, delves into some really deep questions about the nature of art and the importance of art. I know as a philosopher, it's your job to go into those hard questions, but what is it about art specifically that draws you?
I grew up in a family of artists. I've always been surrounded by art and have always had a sense that art was important. I then went into philosophy and studied a lot of science and cognitive science. And the area that I found myself working in within sort of philosophy had to do with the nature of perception and consciousness. And through a number of routes, I started thinking about the way art is in some sense a setting in which to investigate perception and consciousness and human experience. One of the sort of driving ideas in the book is the thought that art is a kind of research, which is not a new idea in the art world, but it was kind of a new idea to me. And I started asking myself, well, what kind of research is it? Mm-hmm. And I came upon the thought that, well, in some ways, although it doesn't quite look like it's the sort of thing that I'm doing, art is a philosophical practice. In some sense, philosophy is an artistic one.
The name of the book is Strange Tools. Why, can you explain that, why you use that metaphor to describe art?
One of the things I'm interested in is in the way in which ordinary tool-using practices, whether it's how you hold your pencil or how you hold a fork and knife or how you drive a car or how you use email, these are the objects that we use to go through life. Exactly. These technologies are not just implements. They're whole systems that organize us. And they're embedded also in functions. We use forks and knives to cut and eat, and we use pens to write. And
can I take you back just a step and say you said that tools organize us? I think a lot of people might think, well, we're the humans. We made them. We organize the tools. What does it mean that the tools organize us?
Well, you say humans invented it, but in some sense, if you wanted to look back through sort of the archaeological time and ask yourself, when did humans begin? Well, the best evidence we have of when we began is when there was this explosion of technological creativity about 30,000 years ago. That's when people started dressing themselves. That's when people started painting in caves. That's when people started not only making blunt instruments for banging, but started making refined tools for the making of tools for ever more specialized purposes. And there seems to be some sense in which the psychologically modern human and the presence of tools in our lives, again, using tools and technologies in this broader sense, really is essential to what it is to be human. It's not like we're over here and these things we use are over there. Mm. The history of technology, in some sense, I think, is the history of constantly changing, evolving patterns of human organization, mm-hmm. which we don't have the freedom to step out of and simply choose. I choose no longer to be influenced by language. I choose no longer to have my visual experience influenced by pictorial technology. I choose no longer to obey the traffic rules. No,
it's impossible.
It's impossible. We're inside it. I think actually one of the few ways that we can reorganize ourselves and emancipate ourselves from habit and social structure is art. And I think that one of the ways art does that, art is not one thing, obviously, but one of the ways art does that is by making things that that break with the pre-established expected functions that they're supposed to have. So it might be a picture, but you ask yourself, well, what is it showing? And or is it showing anything? Or is it always the case that a picture has to show? And what do we need to know in order to see what a picture shows us? And what is it about? And why is it about that? And why did somebody make that? And in other words, the work of art is a tool which is kind of made strange. And in being made strange, at least this is what I argue in the book, it unveils us to ourselves. It brings out all the ways in which so much is taken for granted in the rest of our lives. And I think, and this is a much harder thing to explain, but I think it not only unveils us to ourselves, but it unveils us in a way that gives us resources to be different. One of the things I'm really interested in is that process by which art reveals us to ourselves and gives us resources for changing is kind of one of the ways I would characterize what philosophy is all about, too. Just going back to my point that uh-huh. this is a philosophical practice. And I call them both reorganizational practices because I feel in some sense both art and philosophy are interested in taking the condition from which we start ourselves in and revealing it and then thereby altering it.
And you're going from the assumption that reorganization of ourselves or of how we see things is a good thing. It's a betterment of us as humans.
It's not as though I think through art we progress. But I do think through art we change. And the impulse to change or the impulse to release ourselves from the structures in which we find ourselves is a really powerful one that we have.
As humans.
As humans. One of the images I have is that our lives are these complex nestings of organization within organization of which we are not individually the author. And we're kind of lost, and being lost is kind of anxious. And so the human existential predicament wants to get some kind of a sense of where we are. Mm. And the very fact of getting a sense of where you are changes your relationship to the world. That's what I meant before when I said it doesn't sort of remove structure altogether or take you out of it. For instance, one of the things I'm very interested in is choreography. And the question of what choreography's relation to dancing is.
Uh-huh. Right. You make a distinction between dancing itself and the art of dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. That's exactly the distinction I'm interested in. I'm interested in the way in which dancing is sort of choreography's raw materials or the art of dancing's raw materials. And what's interesting to me about that is we are dancers. We human beings, we dance. We dance spontaneously. Dancing is an expression of our intelligence. Dancing is an expression of our competence.
It's a very primal thing that we do.
I think that's right. Uh-huh. And it also is bound up with all sorts of functions. People dance to celebrate. They dance to release. They dance to show themselves. They dance to make friends. They dance to seduce.
Mating rituals.
Exactly. All of that. Uh-huh. So dancing is caught up with all of that. And then you have these people that come along and say, well, let's extract it from that natural setting and put it on a stage or perform it. Let's now show it. Let's display it. So what's being done is not just more dancing. It's dancing displayed, dancing revealed, dancing investigated, or ourselves displayed. One of the things which is remarkable is in a community where there is choreography, by which I mean where there are sort of shared representations of what dancing looks like, whether it's in the form of James Brown or Baryshnikov, in a world in which there is choreography, that loops back down and affects the way people dance at parties and by themselves and in mating rituals, so that art ends up growing out of a first-order fact about the way we're organized by dancing, in my terminology, but then loops back down and changes the way we're organized. For the better? I don't know, but the changes is definite. Even by yourself, in your most, I mean, I shouldn't make a presumption about you personally, but even by yourself in your room, completely in the most private moment, if you start to boogie, your boogieing will be citing all sorts of images you have of what dancing is, I believe.
Citing, you mean like quoting
things
that I've seen or things that I've experienced that I know to be dance.
Become this kind of entangled, looping, sometimes philosophers speak of sedimented thing that over historical time evolves and changes, and we evolve and change through it.
That was philosopher and author Alva Noe speaking with KALW's Jen Chien. Noe will be giving a performative lecture as part of Hope More Dance Bridges Project on Saturday night at the Joe Good Annex in San Francisco. More information is at KALW.org. Click Cross Currents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba, and now it's time for Audiograph, the Bay Area's sonic signature. Here's KALW's Julie Kane.
All week long, we've been playing you a sound that you can hear every year right around this time.
And but I do want to tell you one more time that the fireworks and the laser show will start sharp at 8 o'clock.
Think you know what that is and where we recorded it? Reporter Sandhya Dirks and her mom bring us this story that first aired last year.
The first thing you encounter when you enter into the Alameda County Fairgrounds is music. Lots and lots of music. There are booths selling Indian clothes, salwar kameez and saris and jewelry, everything in bright colors, purples and red, and of course, saffron orange and monsoon green, the signature colors of India. There's face painting and henna painting. Kids are running around on the open grass, and there's two main stages where people dance and listen to music. This is Diwali, India's biggest festival, and there's a lot going on. I'll let my mother, Leela Wood, explain.
This is sort of the culmination of the festival season.
Diwali.
Yeah.
It's kind of like the end of all the festivals.
Yeah, it's a festival. It's like a New Year's festival. It's a festival of light and beginnings and auspiciousness.
That word, auspiciousness, it's probably a pretty fair giveaway that my mom didn't grow up here. She was born in Bombay, now Mumbai, and she's been back in India for a while now. But this month, she's visiting me. Poor mom, all she wants to do is eat burgers and watch American TV. And I've brought her here to watch a small parade of South Asians in costume, chanting and pushing around statues of gods and goddesses on elaborate platforms, round and round.
So they're basically just going around in circles?
But that's India. We go around in circles.
Diwali marks the end of the circle of the year, the finish and rebirth of a cycle of festivals celebrating gods and goddesses from Ram to Kali to Ganesha. Diwali is quite literally the festival to end all festivals. Think New Year's plus the 4th of July multiplied by Bollywood.
But I do want to tell you one more time that the fireworks and the laser show will start sharp at 8 o'clock.
That's Ramesh Japra. He's the chairman of the Fremont Hindu Temple. It's also known as the Vedic Dharma Samaj, serving one of the largest populations of South Asians in the Bay Area. Back in India, there is a divine chaos to Diwali. The fireworks aren't timed or regulated. They are just everywhere.
having the lights all over, having the fireworks, and in every home we used to have it, but now here in America, because of this fire hazard and everything else, it's not possible to have these fireworks in our own homes, in our own backyard.
For the last 3 years, Japra has been responsible for recreating the divine chaos of Indian Diwali on the manicured lawns of the Alameda County Fairgrounds. He says the anarchic display of lights everywhere might not be replicated, but the message of Diwali remains the same.
So this is a victory of good over evil, and this is from darkness to light, and of course from ignorance to knowledge.
And for 12-year-old Arjun Aral?
Basically what it is the triumph of good over evil. You know, let's just say you're in a presidential race and you're supporting one candidate over another candidate, and that candidate is good, the other candidate is bad in your eyes. That's the triumph of good over evil. That's essentially what Diwali is. It's kind of like an election.
In the wake of the elections, that might seem like a very American interpretation of the Festival of Lights. Aral lives in Dublin, but he says his heart belongs in India.
I was in India 2 years ago for Diwali. I wasn't here, and it was the best Diwali I've ever had in my life. I got to do fireworks. There are tons of sweets. That's probably the best part of it. Snacks and sweets, stuff that you don't get the rest of the year. You know, you can take the boy out of the country, you can't take the country out of the boy.
That's why so many Bay Area Indians are here to celebrate Diwali. The fireworks got rained out this year, but there's still music, dancing, and food. Which reminds me, it's time to get my favorite food, the crisp, wafer-thin pancake known as dosa.
Can I get a masala dosa?
Yeah, sure.
My mother begrudgingly joins me to eat the Indian food. For me, it's a special treat, conjuring the sense memories of my childhood. For Mom, she'd rather be eating a burger. What is rare for both of us is being together. We only see each other once a year, so we walk the fairgrounds, watch the dancing, and I listen to her stories of the Festival of Lights back home in India. Much superior, she says. This Diwali, the brightest light, is my mother's smile. In Pleasanton, I'm Sandhya Dirks for Cross Currents.
Our winner this week is Ensign Pinto. Congratulations! We're going to send you a KALW t-shirt. Thanks for listening and thanks for playing. I'm Julie Kane.
Thanks, Julie. If you've got ideas for where we should record next, tell us about them. Email us at news@kalw.org. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Shireen Adil, Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Ian Lewis, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowlands, Raja Shah, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Hannah Kingsley Ma. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. Today's local music is by Ian Facchini and Rebecca Kleinman of Oakland. That's him on the guitar and her on the flute. And they're performing original Brazilian-inspired songs scheduled for Saturday night at Wisteria Ways in Oakland. The music begins at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.